Your North Carolina Reading Service presents The Indie Week. I'm John Federson for the North Carolina Reading Service, reading this weekly tabloid dated today, June 9th of 2021, for our audience of blind and print-impaired listeners. Glad you're with us, and also our musicians. But today, a special surprise, I'm not going to tell you anything about them. So keep it a deep, dark secret. And we'll get started with our issue now. And we'll begin with our Voices column. And today is by Nikolai Mather, freelance writer in Chapel Hill. Pittsburgh is a town divided. On Monday, May 31st, my phone lit up with a message from Pittsburgh anti-racist alerts. White supremacists had once again gathered in Pittsburgh's town center to fly Confederate battle flags. This stubborn vigil began 2 years ago when the Board of County Commissioners started considering the removal of Pittsburgh's Confederate monument. And though the statue is long gone, the racist opposition continues to assert itself in my hometown by disseminating neo-Confederate screeds online, by attempting to push the school board and county political bodies further right, and by menacing downtown Pittsburgh and the rest of Chatham County with hate symbols. This protracted reaction has everything to do with racism. But in looking back on the years of white supremacist protest in Chatham County, the connection to, or rather manipulation of, class conflict is also laid bare. Pittsburgh's uneasy marriage to the progressive suburban triangle has spurred drastic change in Chatham County, causing tension between longtime locals and transplant residents. White supremacists have been able to exploit that tension to justify their cause. North Carolina has a profound urban-rural divide. The NC Rural Center has found that rural counties tend to have higher poverty rates, lower average incomes, and less access to health care and higher education. Most rural counties in North Carolina are experiencing a significant decline in population, leaving many communities even more unstable than before. Chatham County is one of the few exceptions. Since 2010, its population has grown by 16.3%, outpacing neighboring counties like Orange and Durham. North Chatham, in particular, has exploded with new arrivals. Massive housing developments like Briar Chapel and Chatham Park have brought in tens of thousands of people and will only attract more as construction progresses. There remain significant differences between newer residents and those who have roots in Chatham County. Chatham's median household income in 2019 was $67,000. In Briar Chapel, it was $84,700. Many transplants do white-collar work and commute to the Triangle. Longtime residents are more likely to do local blue-collar work. Many transplants are solidly progressive, at odds with the more conservative residents who live in rural parts of the county. Growing up in North Chatham, the class division was readily apparent, even at the high school level. Who got dropped off, and who had to take long bus rides? Who went on to college, and who stayed in town? Who worked part-time out of necessity, and who didn't? It's fair to say that a lot of people in Chatham County feel cheated out of the prosperity our newer neighbors have acquired. Throughout the Confederate statue conflict, these sentiments resurfaced in the arguments of the racist opposition. At one county meeting in May 2019, several people alluded to the tension between transplants and locals during a public input session. Brantley Webster, who sat on the board for the Chatham County Historical Association, said it was merely outside activists agitating for change. Keith Roberts pointed out that those supporting removal have fine homes in the northern part of Chatham. But it was Kevin Stone, the Chatham County probation officer, revealed to have ties to the North Carolina Sons of Confederate Veterans, who made the most distinct reference. Unfortunately, he said, as most working-class people, we don't have the resources nor time that our opponents in this matter of removing the statute do. And we know that our attempts to appeal to reason and moderation are falling on deaf ears. I don't mean to suggest that Chatham County's neo-Confederates are primarily motivated by class, nor do I think that white supremacists can be forgiven for racial terrorism due to class background. The fetishization of the white rural working class in the United States has at this point become parodic. From J.D. Vance's Hillbilly Elegy to the proliferation of Old Guy in a South Carolina Diner Tells Us Why He Voted for Trump in journalism, there's no shortage of sympathy for white people in rural areas, even, and sometimes especially, if they're racist. When taken with the rise of white rural demagogues like Madison Cawthorn and the continued domination of white rural Republican interests over North Carolina politics, it's easy to see how this identity is used to further the aims of white supremacy. Above all, it has allowed racists to reestablish control over the narrative. Instead of racists versus anti-racists, it's transplants versus natives. Instead of racists versus anti-racists, it's the working class versus the upper middle classes. This distorted thinking allowed them to capture state attention in 2019. It drives them to continue their campaign of racial intimidation, no matter where the statue now stands. Maybe it's too late to make that point. That thinking is already championed by so many, not just in Pittsburgh, but Graham, Wilmington, and every other small town struggling with its white supremacist past. However, as Chatham County continues to expand, it is imperative that we put that myth to rest. Transplants are making irrevocable and, at times, unwanted changes here. The solution is not allowing racists to speak for local interest. The solution is to empower those spoken over, the black Chathamites who can trace their family lineage back hundreds of years, the growing community of working-class Latinx people in South Chatham, and the rural working-class white people who lead anti-racist lives. We can't settle for easy stories about slighted white conservatives waving Confederate flags by the courthouse. Otherwise, they'll just keep showing up. On to our news columns. Carol Espinoza-Jane brings us a column from Raleigh called Money to Burn. Following a year of hardship, Raleigh City Manager Marshall Adams David is optimistic. The city has a renewed spirit of hope, she wrote in a message last month, and with that new spirit of hope comes a $1.07 billion proposed city budget. But many Raleigh residents didn't share that spirit of hope during the budget public hearing last week. More than 20 public speakers denounced a proposed $4.8 million funding increase for the Raleigh Police Department, which came under fire from residents last year for using tear gas and other weapons against protesters, involvement in the deaths of multiple men of color since 2013, and more recently, drug framing black residents in Raleigh. Braxton Brewington, a resident who spoke at the June 1st public hearing, "We do not need to reform the ways that the police kill us." He added it was embarrassing to see an increase in the police budget following last year's protests for racial equity. "We don't need to make the police sign forms before the police murder us. We need to end the murder, their stakes into violence." This is not the first time the council has heard calls for police reform and defunding from black residents and activists. Last year, following violent confrontations between Raleigh police officers and protesters condemning racial violence after the death of George Floyd, the council held a special session to hear public comments around potentially reforming the Raleigh Police Department. Since then, the police department has undergone some reform measures, including instituting a ban on chokeholds and strangleholds, implementation of the ACORNS unit, which means addressing crisis through outreach, referrals, networking, and service, as well as a racial equity training for council members that has been proposed. Some policing policies, including 5 of the 8 can't wait reform proposals, the city had already implemented prior to last year's protests. The last fiscal year was the only year the Raleigh Police Department did not receive a funding increase since 2008. During last week's public hearing, City Manager Adams David said a large portion of the increased funding was part of a state-mandated requirement to compensate retiring law enforcement officers. The other portion of the budget increase, meanwhile, provides resources for new non-sworn personnel, including crisis and trauma counselors, family violence units, and community ambassadors, as well as an upcoming Greenway patrol team after instances of violence in the city's Greenway. Adams Davis said, "So much of the $5 million increase we have combed through the budget with a fine-tooth comb. Dollar amounts we have no control over. They're mandated requirements from the state." But many attendees were dissatisfied with the city manager's response. Reeves Peeler, a Raleigh resident and speaker at the public hearing, said a required police pension should not mean an increase in the police budget. Peeler said, "We can buy less ammunition for weapons for RPD. We can buy less gasoline for their cars. We can buy less cars. We can also hire less officers." Brian Collin, another speaker, criticized the newly implemented ACORNS unit, saying social workers should not be working side by side with police departments. He said, "The concern I have is when all you have is a hammer, everything's a nail, and eventually these programs will turn into just another extension into the violent policing of the working class parts of Raleigh, the black and brown parts of Raleigh," Coleman said. "It'd be a better social good to take that $5 million, take it out in cash, and burn it in Nash Square, then give it to the RPD." Many attending residents cited support for Refund Raleigh's budget proposals, which call for a 30% reduction in the Raleigh Police Department's officer force. Refund Raleigh, a local collective calling for the defunding and demilitarization of Raleigh Police Department, is also partnering with the Raleigh chapter of the Public Service Workers Union, UE Local 150, to demand a $20 minimum wage for city workers and a permanent free bus fares once the pandemic is out of sight. Grant Bunn, a speaker and supporter of Refund Raleigh's proposals, criticized the city council's adoption of 8 Can't Wait and policies suggested by the consulting firm 21CP to reform the police department. "Both were inefficient ways to end police violence," he said. And he said, "If this council wants to keep us safe, you can invest in actual community needs by giving city workers a living wage, truly solving our housing crisis, making all transportation permanently free, and increasing the economic safety net for all residents." Residents also criticized the city council for being averse to listening to public comments, with many of the speakers slamming the 60-second speaking time limit. Delaney Vandergrift, a youth engagement coordinator at the NC Black Leadership Organizing Collective, singled out city council members Corey Branch and Jonathan Melton for not publicly standing up for the black neighborhoods they represent and reside in. Vandergrift said, "We can no longer accept your private, whispered conviction. Do you care about black people? Do you care about your neighbors? Find the courage to speak about it loudly and quick." In a phone interview with the Indy, Mayor Mary Ann Baldwin said the council will discuss changes to the proposed city budget this week. As of now, city council members are waiting to see how everyone feels about the feedback from both within and outside the public hearing before beginning to finalize the budget. She said, "I'll have a better idea where everybody stands in relation to the budget at that time. And oftentimes budget will be something that requires some compromise and discussion, so I'm reserving any judgment before I hear what everyone has to say in an open session." Next, Tomasi McDonald, news from Durham. Conspiracy theory. Jimori Bumpas, initially died in a car accident, investigators said, when he crashed his vehicle into a power pole after Durham County Sheriff's deputies tried to pull him over down a dark road in North Durham in December of 2019. But the story quickly changed. It was a self-inflicted gunshot wound that killed the 18-year-old black man, the sheriff's office said, days later. But the teen's family believes something different, something far more sinister. The family has filed a federal civil rights lawsuit that accuses the two deputies who pulled over Bumpus of killing him and conspiring to cover it up. Sheriff Clarence Burkhead was among those named in the complaint for his role in the alleged conspiracy. Sheriff's office spokeswoman Anne-Marie Breen said in an email to Indy that the department typically does not comment on pending litigation, but added that the two deputies, Anthony Sharp Jr. and Robert Osborne, who pulled over Bumpus, neither fired their weapon nor in any other way caused his death. The Bumpus family isn't convinced. Almost from the moment Bumpus died, his family has wondered what really happened to the teen, a young man with no criminal record or history of depression, suicidal threats, or other mental issues, according to his family. As previously reported by the Indy, Sharp and Osborne claim Bumpus' death was a suicide, with Sharp stating in an incident report that he heard a gunshot, saw the car accelerate forward, heard the crash, called for backup units, drove to the crash scene, and waited for backup to arrive. Sharp reported when he approached the car, he found Bumpus, quote, lying torso down in the vehicle. In between his legs was a Desert Tan Glock semi-automatic handgun. The barrel of the gun was expelling smoke, as if it had just been fired. The complaint, filed May 18th in U.S. District Court for the Middle District of North Carolina, however, accuses Sharp and Osborne of acting in concert to shoot Bumpus with a single bullet to the head. The complaint filed on behalf of the Bumpus family by Durham attorney Alan Sharp, no relation to Deputy Sharp, also accuses Burkhead of obstructing justice and being a willing partner in covering up what Osborne and Sharp did. The complaint alleges that Burkhead and his deputies, quote, intentionally issued misleading press releases, made false statements and reports, destroyed evidence, provided false information to the medical examiners and the State Bureau of Investigation, withheld crucial information from the Bumpus family while knowingly misrepresenting what had been produced, and made material misrepresentations and omissions to Mr. Bumpus' family and to the Superior Court, unquote. The complaint also suggests a possible motive for the fatal shooting. Sharp, who was hired by the sheriff's office in 2012, had a history with Bumpus men during traffic stops. In August of 2016, Sharp arrested Timothy Bumpus Jr. on drug charges after conducting a traffic stop for an inoperable license plate light. Then 7 months later, Sharp arrested Timothy Bumpus Sr. on gun and drug charges after another traffic stop, reportedly for speeding, according to the complaint. Timothy Bumpus Jr. and Timothy Bumpus Sr. are distant cousins of Jimori Bumpus, whom he never met, according to the family. At the time of Jimori's death, Timothy Sr. was in custody at the Durham County Jail for gun and drug charges stemming from Sharp's arrest, but he was in the process of contesting those charges. Quote, when Defendant Sharp and Osborne pulled Jimori Bumpus over, Defendant Sharp was scheduled to testify at a suppression hearing in Durham County Superior Court that upcoming week of December 16, 2019, in the criminal case of State versus Timothy Bumpus, in which Timothy Bumpus Sr. was challenging the legality of the March 2017 traffic stop conducted by Defendant Sharp, which led to his gun and drug charges, states the complaint. It was in the early morning hours of December 15, 2019, when Bumpus was driving a Chevrolet Impala he owned that was displaying the license plate of a Honda Accord that he also owned. The complaint states that Bumpus had recently traded in the Accord for the Impala and was waiting for the title to the Impala to arrive in the mail so he could register the car with the tag from the Impala. The complaint states that Bumpus was on the phone with a friend while driving to his mother's house to pick up his sister when the deputies pulled him over at 12:39 a.m., less than a mile from her home. Bumpus told his friend that the police had been following him for a while and wondered if they were going to pull him over, the complaint states. Mr. Bumpus told his friend something didn't feel right, according to the complaint. His friend told him if he did not trust the situation to keep his car in drive. The slain teen's friend heard the deputies speak to Bumpus, then heard a gunshot, the car crash, and then either Defendant Sharp or Defendant Osborne tell the other deputy, "Oh, shoot, he's on the phone," according to the complaint. In the lawsuit, the family paints a picture of a motivated young man who received good grades and graduated one semester early from Hillside High School, not a teen with motivations to kill himself. He lived with his mom, regularly spent time at his father's home, played drums for Baha'i worship services, and worked at FedEx while preparing to attend college and study sports medicine. The complaint lists a cache of troubling actions on the part of both the deputies and Sheriff Burkhead, such as the deputies driving a vehicle with an inoperative in-car camera system in violation of county policy. What's more, the complaint alleges that the teen's investigative file is being kept from his family to run out the clock on the 2-year statute of limitations for wrongful death lawsuits. According to the complaint, the wrongful acts of the two deputies resulted in Bumpus being stopped, seized, shot, and killed, and the teen's parents have suffered loss of society and companionship as well as severe emotional distress as a consequence of not only losing their son, but from the cover-up and false report of the suicide, which entitles the family to compensatory and punitive damages. Greg Barnes, pipeline problems. For years, individual case studies have found that natural gas pipelines traverse primarily through socially vulnerable communities, resulting in cries of environmental injustice and lawsuits against big gas companies. Now, researchers at North Carolina State University have taken these studies a step further with a deep data dive to show that the nation's counties with the most socially vulnerable populations have significantly higher pipeline densities. The findings suggest that people living in those counties are at greater risk of facing water and air pollution, public health and safety issues, and other negative impacts associated with the natural gas pipelines, said Laura Olesniak, a spokesman for North Carolina State. Ryan Emanuel, the study's lead researcher and a professor at NC State's Center for Geospatial Analytics, says, "This is what the communities themselves have been saying for a long time. For the first time, we gathered all of this together and zoomed out and took a national look and said, you know what? These pipelines don't exist in a vacuum." The study has been peer-reviewed and is being published in GeoHealth, a journal that focuses on the intersection of environmental and earth sciences and health. The authors drew their conclusions using data on socially vulnerable communities from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and natural gas pipeline data from the U.S. Energy Information Administration, Emanuel said. The researchers used CDC's data to examine socially vulnerable communities on a county-by-county basis. CDC defines social vulnerability as the potential negative effects on communities caused by external stresses on human health. Such stresses include natural or human-caused disasters or disease outbreaks. In 2014, Dominion Energy and Duke Energy announced they would construct the Atlantic Coast Pipeline from the shale fields of West Virginia through Virginia and ending in Robeson County in North Carolina. At the time, the proposed 600-mile-long pipeline was projected to cost between $4.5 and $5 billion. The two energy companies said demand for the project was driven in large part by retirement and conversion of coal-fired plants to natural gas. But as the companies bought easements for the pipeline, either with cooperation from landowners or by the seizing of property through eminent domain, federal regulators began to question the need for the pipeline because the Mountain Valley Pipeline was beginning to take shape nearby. Emanuel said the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission heavily weighed the need for the Atlantic Coast Pipeline but gave little consideration to the environmental justice issue. And he said, so we know that regulators take these kinds of, gas supply issues into account for the rest of the network when they're making these decisions, but right now they don't do that when it comes to environmental justice. Pipelines are more or less considered in a vacuum when it comes to reviewing their environmental justice implications. Last July, Dominion and Duke announced they were scrapping the Atlantic Coast Pipeline, blaming costs that had ballooned to $8 billion and anticipated delays in permitting and construction, caused in part by lawsuits and federal court rulings. In a joint statement on July 5, 2020, Dominion Chairman Thomas Farrell and Duke Chairman Lynn Good announced the pipeline's cancellation. Quote, we regret we will be unable to complete the Atlantic Coast Pipeline. For almost 6 years, we have worked diligently and invested billions of dollars to complete the project and deliver the much-needed infrastructure to our customers and communities. Throughout, we have engaged extensively with and incorporated feedback from local communities, labor and industrial leaders, government and permitting agencies, environmental interests, and social justice organizations. This announcement reflects the increasing legal uncertainty that overhangs large-scale energy and industrial infrastructure development in the United States. Until these issues are resolved, the ability to satisfy the country's energy needs will be significantly challenged, unquote. Emanuel and others believe the lawsuits over environmental issues, including environmental injustice, were among the primary reason that the pipeline was canceled. Last year, a federal court invalidated a key permit for a natural gas compressor station as part of the pipeline. That station would have been built in Union Hill, a historic black community in Virginia founded by freed slaves after the Civil War. The court ruling was hailed as a major victory for the environmental justice movement. Emanuel thinks his study will bring environmental injustice issues even more into the forefront. He said, what I hope we can take away from this study is that when new pipelines come up for review, the environmental justice component of that review won't be treated in isolation. We'll think about what we are doing to the whole network when we add a new pipeline with respect to environmental justice. Are we re-entrenching the historic patterns that already exist in the landscape, or are we going to do something different? The recent boom in extracting natural gas from shale deep underground, a practice known as hydraulic fracturing or fracking, has resulted in an ever-increasing number of pipelines being proposed and constructed in the United States. With that comes the increasing burden of determining where the pipelines should go that will have the fewest environmental and social impacts. And the study puts it this way. The pace of U.S. pipeline development signals an urgent need for research about health, socioeconomic, and other impacts associated with pipelines and other midstream infrastructure. In particular, there is a pressing need to understand the extent to which large-scale, that is, regional or national, distribution of midstream pipelines may create or exacerbate societal inequities in environmental degradation, exposure to health risks, and other harms. Citing U.S. Department of Transportation figures, the study says federal regulators documented 36 fatalities, 164 injuries, and about $2.5 billion in costs associated with industry reported incidents from natural gas gathering and transmission pipelines. Problems with pipelines have been in the news in North Carolina of late, with a recent ransomware attack on the management of the Colonial Pipeline, which carries multiple petroleum products up and down the East Coast. A failure of that same pipeline was responsible for a million-gallon petroleum leak in Huntersville in August of 2020. The study was conducted by Emmanuel and Louis Rivers III of NC State, Martina Angela Carretta of Sweden's Lund University, and Pavitra Vasudevan of the University of Texas. It did not attempt to offer solutions on how to mitigate pipeline development in socially vulnerable communities. Energy companies have long argued that placing pipelines near large cities would make little sense because a catastrophic event could endanger far more people. That's one reason they choose rural areas, even though more socially vulnerable people typically live there. Emmanuel said he isn't sure what the answer is, but he'd like the country to start a concerted effort to dramatically curb its dependence on natural gas. He said, if you're going to keep building these pipelines, you're going to have to deal with the impacts to either urban communities or rural communities. Maybe it's a catch-22. I'm not really sure. Emmanuel is not the only one who thinks it's time for the United States to curtail or eliminate the use of natural gas in the pursuit of stopping global warming. The Wall Street Journal reported in May that a growing fight is emerging across the United States as, quote, cities consider phasing out natural gas for home cooking and heating, citing concerns about climate change. According to the publication, San Francisco, Seattle, Denver, and New York have either enacted or proposed measures to ban or discourage the use of natural gas in new homes and buildings. Meanwhile, Arizona, Texas, Oklahoma, Tennessee, Kansas, and Louisiana have enacted laws outlawing municipal bans on fossil fuels in their states before they can spread, saying they are overly restrictive and costly. Now, that above story was originally published by North Carolina Health News. Well, the cover story on the Indie Week concerns UNC Chapel Hill's refusal to grant tenure to Nicole Hannah Jones. And Sarah Pequeña writes, it's emblematic of the systemic racism chronicled in the 1619 Project. At the end of the final episode of the 1619 podcast, Nicole Hannah Jones chokes up as she looks out onto the water where the first ships brought enslaved Africans to colonial Virginia. She says, the one thing I didn't realize when I started this project was how raw everything still is when you're black in this country, and white people always want to tell you to get over it and to move on. But there's never been a reckoning for what was done, and it's hard to move on. And just spending so much time thinking about it constantly, I just realized that the wounds are still very raw. They're still there. The show premiered in 2019 upon publication of the 1619 Project in the New York Times Magazine. It was about 18 months before the Board of Trustees at Hannah Jones' alma mater, UNC Chapel Hill, refused to hire her with tenure for her position as Knight Chair in Race and Investigative Journalism, and then refused to reconsider that decision, despite the threat of a lawsuit and the repeated endorsement of Hannah Jones from the journalism school faculty. The controversy stems from this 2019 body of work. Hannah Jones' story is not unique. In 2019, there were 8 black women serving as full tenured professors at UNC Chapel Hill and 23 tenured associate professors, a total of 31 black women with tenure, down from a high of 32 in 2017. White men, on the other hand, held 337 tenured full professorships and 148 tenured associate positions that year, 485 tenured, down from a high of 535 in 2017. At public and private universities in North Carolina and across the country at predominantly white institutions, but sometimes at historically black colleges and universities, black professors, especially ones with other marginalized identities, do not receive tenure at the same rate as do their white counterparts. Sonia Haynes Stone, now the namesake of UNC's Center for Black Culture and History, came to the university in 1974, a few years after the Black Student Movement had demanded the creation of an African-American studies program. She held two master's degrees and earned her Ph.D. in the year after joining the faculty. She was director of the curriculum of the African-American Studies program. She helped develop the National Council of Black Studies. She received a grant from the Rockefeller Foundation to start the Southeastern Black Press Institute. She was on committees for UNC's Black Cultural Center, the recruitment of black faculty, and the Campus Y, and served as an advisor to the black student movement. It wasn't enough. In 1979, the university's chancellor, provost, and dean of the College of Arts and Sciences denied her tenure. Black students wrote in a letter to the Daily Tar Heel, "Stone has fallen victim to a growing trend. Across the country, more and more qualified black professors are being denied tenure at institutions of higher education. This trend is not only a slap in the face to black scholars, but in the long run, it will be a severe constraint on the quality of education available to the youth of the nation." Stone appealed, and her tenured dossier went before the UNC Board of Trustees. 200 students crammed into Morehead Planetarium to support her. Harry Amana, the first black professor hired by UNC's journalism school, was interviewed by Stone during his recruitment. He came to the university the same year her tenure battle began. Amana said, told the Indy, "They took it to an outside arbitrator, and it was decided that the people who evaluated her work knew nothing about African-American studies." Her packet was sent outside the university to noted scholars and historians in the field of African-American studies, and that's how she got the recommendation for tenure. The UNC Board of Trustees and the Board of Governors finally awarded Stone tenure, but with a catch. She was not given a promotion and stayed an assistant professor. Amana says, "She was one of maybe two or three people on the whole campus who had tenure as an assistant professor." Stone wasn't named an associate professor until 1984. She was still an associate when she died unexpectedly in 1991. Sharon P. Holland, now a distinguished professor in American Studies at UNC Chapel Hill, has moved around a lot. She's often an outlier, and not just because of her race. Holland, who is queer and gender nonconforming, says that additional identity made her an exception, even among black professors. She says, "Everywhere I've been one of a handful, if not the only, out black women on campus. And in several of the places where I either was a tenure track or gained tenure, I was actually the first tenured black person full-time in that department." As a postdoctoral research at Wesleyan, Holland recalls the chair of her department told her that she and other postdoc students were supposed to be at the office from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. every weekday except Friday. One weekend, she left town to workshop a chapter with some classmates from graduate school. They got snowed in, and Holland had to miss work that day. She says, "I called the chair, and she just chewed me out for like half an hour about me being irresponsible. Clearly, what was happening was ridiculous, but I didn't know that. I was a postdoc, fresh out of grad school." Holland worked up the nerve to bring this slight to the director of their program. It was through him that she found out that there was no such rule requiring postdoctoral students to be at the office for a set amount of time. From there, Holland decided to end her position early to make up for lost time and headed to Stanford. While there, her close friend and colleague, Laura Romero, died by suicide. They'd grown apart in recent years, since Holland was queer and Romero was bisexual. Others in the department assumed that a romantic relationship had fizzled and led to Romero's death. Holland says, "It allowed certain members of the department to basically say, well, if Sharon hadn't treated Laura so badly, Laura wouldn't have killed herself. I kind of felt held responsible for that, and so I had to leave. You can't stay. You can't stay when people are not only being ungenerous, but also stupid and homophobic. Other incidents at other universities were in line with the microaggressions Holland experienced, a secretary not allowing her into a meeting that was being held for her specifically, a potential hire assuming she was an office manager instead of on the hiring committee. Her work was also undervalued in a literal sense. She says she took a $35,000 pay cut when she left a job at Duke University to come to UNC Chapel Hill. In 2020, the Daily Tar Heel reported that Holland had previously considered leaving if the university did not increase her pay at UNC and gave her the resources to create the critical ethnic studies collective. A university spokesman said in response to a request for comment from Indy, "Carolina is committed to creating and sustaining an inclusive community of students, faculty, and staff. We are dedicated to building a diverse learning environment with the highest caliber faculty, and we remain committed to that mission." While Holland beat the odds, she still feels the weight of her experiences and acknowledges how few distinguished black professors there are. Sometimes, like with the case of Stone, or with the recent death of Professor Randall Keenan, the pool just keeps getting smaller. Hannah Jones, Stone's and Holland's experiences are not singular struggles for recognition, nor does it appear that there was a time when these struggles weren't present for black women working in academia. In 2013, a public relations professor named Queenie Byers and her husband, Napoleon, decided to retire from the UNC Journalism School after Queenie was denied tenure. Despite getting faculty approval and her decades of experience doing PR for the U.S. Air Force and teaching at Carolina, an outside board composed of professionals from across the United States denied her. The problem also exists at other universities in the Triangle. North Carolina State University had 9 black women full professors and 10 tenured associate professors in 2019. Duke University had 8 and 12, respectively. Some black women academics consider themselves lucky. Dr. Khalila R. Johnson, an assistant professor on tenure track at the UNC School of Medicine, says she has supportive faculty members surrounding her who aren't concerned with her outspokenness on racism in the university. Despite this, she's constantly aware of the possibility that her public stances on issues like Silent Sam could mean backlash from the Board of Trustees. She says, "I exceed every benchmark, really, that the university puts forward, so on paper it would seem I shouldn't have any issues. But the reality of it is I'm a very public-facing academic. I have a reputation, good or bad, in some professional circles for being vocal, and I'm aware that people at my institution know that. I think the possibility of not being promoted is real, but I can't worry about that." Amana, similarly, says his tenure process in the 1970s was not as stressful as it was for others, since he had the support of the UNCCH Journalism School's dean at the time. We still don't know what will become of Hannah Jones' position at UNC Chapel Hill. As of the publication of this story, she has not said whether she will still go to work in Carroll Hall this upcoming school year, as was planned. In the meantime, the board's decision is clearly driving a wedge further between UNC's self-proclaimed investment in diversity and the reality of its academic environment. Lisa Jones, a world-renowned chemist, rescinded her candidacy for coming to UNC Chapel Hill after seeing the experience of Hannah Jones. Lindsay Carbonell, an adjunct professor at the Hussman School, announced that she won't be returning. Jones is a black woman. Carbonell is white, but cited Hannah Jones' treatment as her reason for leaving UNC. Quote, "I feel that a premier university in a state where my family's blood is in the soil is missing the opportunity to remain a premier university. And when I say premier, I'm not talking about status. I'm talking about absolutely leading the way and what we do especially in this region and this part of the world, what we do for our future as human beings. It is a profound lack of vision. People are concentrated, fixated on what we can and cannot do because 12 people, 6 people, 8 people in a room have made it difficult. That's more like the slaveocracy than anything. And we need to break that legacy. Well, let's move now to a food and drink section, article by Lena Geller, and it's called Bulk Good. Long before the pandemic, Jonah Sanville knew what it was like to take off a mask at the end of a workday. During their first year in the workforce, Sanville, who has autism, was upfront with employers about their neurodivergence. But after realizing that employers were unwilling to accommodate their needs as a disabled person, and that once made aware of Sanville's autism, they would often treat them worse than their neurotypical coworkers, Sanville decided to do everything they could to conceal their disability. "I did my very best to not be autistic," Sanville says. "It worked and worked until I couldn't pretend anymore. So then I would come out as autistic, or through my actions I would come out as autistic, and I would get treated poorly again." Sanville, 25, said they've held somewhere around 12 different jobs since entering the workforce 6 years ago. But a new chapter is starting. Last month, Sanville began work at Part and Parcel, a new bulk dry goods store in downtown Durham committed to hiring employees of all neurotypes. Sanville says, "I've definitely had better integration here than at any other job. It's been very accepting and accommodating of my disabilities." In efforts to reduce packaging waste and promote environmental justice, bulk grocery shop Part and Parcel offers a package-free shopping experience, carrying dry good items, cleaning supplies, and personal care products all in bulk. Customers are asked to bring their own containers, plastic Tupperware, glass jars, tote bags, and fill them with goods, which are then sold by weight. The store's interior looks similar to the bulk section at Whole Foods, with large, clear cases holding spices, nuts, beans, and a variety of flours, as well as dish soap, shampoo, conditioner, and lotion. Part and Parcel affords shoppers an eco-friendly way to stock up on the basics without having to purchase products in mass quantities, as is the usual trade-off with buying in bulk. Because of the store's proximity to the Durham Farmers Market, owner T. Land says they foresee Saturday morning shoppers stopping by Part and Parcel to get their dry goods after picking up produce at the market. Land, the executive director of Durham's Autism Support and Advocacy Center, opened Part and Parcel in May as an offshoot of their nonprofit. Land says their decision to open the store was rooted in a desire to create employment opportunities for the neurodivergent community. Land says, "I was running programming for high school students who have autism, looking towards what they would be doing post-grad. Students had lots of skills and assets that were ready for the workforce, but it was really difficult for employers to be willing to take the change." That might mean take the challenge. I'm not sure. With Part and Parcel, Land aims to create a space where neurodivergent people feel comfortable bringing their full identity to work and advocating for the tools they need to be successful. And Land says, "Masking one's identity is exhausting and does not help anyone be their most productive and creative selves." To support their staff, Land allows employees to take breaks as needed, wear comfortable clothing, and help design organizational processes in ways that work for them. In collaboration with employees who are visual learners, for example, Land has developed picture-based guides to illustrate tasks like cleaning and restocking goods. Lan says, this structure is very clear. It's very direct. It means anyone can jump in and know exactly what the expectation is. Most of the things you would put in place to support a neurodivergent employee also helps your neurotypical employees. Beyond providing sustainable employment, the Package Free Store also strives to promote sustainability in environmental practices. About 30% of municipal solid waste in the United States comes from packaging material, according to the EPA, with over 30 million tons of packaging waste ending up in landfills each year. Lund says most packaging is excessive to serve the end of convenience. In stores, sometimes you'll see three bananas on a styrofoam tray wrapped in plastic. Bananas have their own natural wrapper. North Carolina landfills are, quote, disproportionately located in communities of color and low wealth, causing long-term negative effects on residents' health and property value, according to an Environmental Health Perspectives study. Most of Durham's trash gets sent to a solid waste facility in Sampson County, where nearly a quarter of the population lives below the poverty line. Land says, it's environmental racism. The landfill is there because white communities who have more power and privilege are making sure it's not in their community. Though the operation is currently small scale, Land has a number of plans to expand in the coming year, including broadening part and parcel product selection and using the space to house a market for neurodiverse vendors. And the store is just the first piece of providing employment under the Autism Support and Advocacy Center, Land says. They intend to acquire the apartment above part and parcel and turn it into an Airbnb unit, hiring neurodivergent employees to maintain it. And Len says, workplaces need to be able to see the strength and the ability in neurodiversity. We want to be the model for that. We want the community to see that it's replicable. And also from food and drink, I believe I have about 5 minutes left in this broadcast, so I will get what I can in Sowing the Seeds by Eric Ginsberg. And it's a new Netflix series on black foodways, and there's a local preservationist, Gabrielle Carter, who gets her due. And he writes, it makes perfect sense that Netflix's new series, High on the Hog, How African-American Cuisine Transformed America, would include Gabrielle E. W. Carter. The Apex native and cultural preservationist has done a little bit of everything, from working with acclaimed chef J.J. Johnson to hosting communal dinners inspired by her family's culinary traditions. Most recently, as a co-founder of Tall Grass Food Box, alongside Gerald Harris and Derek Beasley, Carter created a way for Triangle residents to directly support local black farmers through and beyond the pandemic. Hosted by sommelier and Whetstone magazine founder Stephen Satterfield, High on the Hog is a narrative correction focusing on the foundational role that African ingredients, techniques, and culinary knowledge played in the formation of the American table. It also illustrates the countless historical and current black and African American figures who drew from this wellspring, including Carter, who is one of the most recognized standard bearers and inheritors of that proud tradition in this region and state. And in a recent conversation with the Indy, Carter discussed her preservation work, family land, and reclaiming red hot links. And this is presented in a question and answer format. There's been a celebratory outpouring and admiration for High on the Hog, including the portion of Episode 2 that highlights your work and your family's homesteading in Apex. What stands out to you about the responses you've been getting directly? I think how necessary it is and how we've been needing something like this for a long time. All types of black folks throughout the diaspora are reaching out from Brazil and Panama and all over, directly and more broadly, who are just excited to see themselves in this context and to have something that feels like it's for us. It was written with us in mind. The whole process was done thoughtfully and non-linear, which I think is a very beautiful and black way of telling stories. What does the series mean to you personally? I've had a few friends over to watch the first two episodes, and we just cried so many different types of tears. First, it was awesome to see Steven Satterfield telling the story, to see his vulnerability and honesty and transparency on the screen like that was powerful, and then also to see them in a place like Benin, telling a story of culture and art and food that didn't center enslavement, talking about life before that, and how those traditions remain and exist and are being passed forward. That felt very powerful and like something I have never seen. In a recent Instagram post, Satterfield refers to you writing that, quote, her family becomes a proxy for ours. What does that mean to you? I love that he said that. I think of my work as a cultural preservationist. I hope to create a framework for other artists to intentionally preserve the culture. It's really about the questions we ask, the time we spend. It's about us deeming these things important and archiving them in whatever way we can. I hope that my work will serve as a framework for others to do the work of preserving our culture. It's going to take all of us telling our individual stories and unearthing some of the older stories that are with some of the griots and culture keepers in our communities. There's this sense of discovery that comes from this work that helps me ground myself in something bigger than myself. To see other people discovering their family history is rewarding in a way that I don't have words for. And this is about the end of, as far as I can go in this long article, most of which I have left unread. And you can find it, though, by going to the website from IndieWeek.com and talking about Tallgrass Food Box, which she began, and Seizing Family Farm, state of North Carolina. Then you can say, and talking about the hot dogs, the red hot links, and it's been, the interview itself was edited for length, so I'm very sorry that I can't get to any more. But with that, we have to close our Indie Week broadcast for this week. The show itself will be appearing for the foreseeable future in our podcast section at our website, ncreadingservice.org. So once again, we thank you for listening to the ncreadingservice.org. Come in next week for another edition of Indie Week. John Federson, so long for now.